HomeschoolHeartbeat.com. That's HomeschoolHeartbeat.com.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. I have Professor Francis O'Gorman on the phone with me from Edinburgh. He's the Saintsbury Professor of English Literature there at the University of Edinburgh. He's written a fabulous book that came out last year from Bloomsbury entitled Forgetfulness, Making the Modern Culture of Amnesia. And before we start talking about that, let me just tell you a little bit about Francis O'Gorman. He comes from a background English, Irish, Hungarian. He was an Oregon scholar at Lady Margaret Hall in Oxford, where he took a double first and a doctorate in English, author of editor of 23 books. That's a lot. His last two books have been a little different. His last book was entitled Worrying, A Literary and Cultural History, also from Bloomsbury, which was very highly thought of. And for 10 years before going to the University of Edinburgh, he held a chair in the School of English at the University of Leeds. And this is what he says. When not working, he likes playing the organ, walking author's seat, or sitting in a bar. Francis O'Gorman, do we find you in a bar as we speak?
I'm sitting in my, sadly, quite a long way away from a bar.
Okay. Well, your book is, frankly, to me, a stunning achievement at a lot of different levels, and I hope we can cover most of them in the hour ahead. But why don't we begin with your general thesis, and if I were to state it offhand, having just put down the book, just finished it, that modernity has become synonymous with not only disregarding the past, and also, as you put it, privileging everything in the future, but actually actively trying to destroy the past, eliminate it from our consciousness. Is that a fair summary of your main theme?
I certainly think that I would very much agree with the first half of that summary. Yes, I think for a very large number of reasons, modernity, which is a term I'm using really to cover the last 200 and so years, has detached itself from a serious and kind of non-judgmental reading of the past. My case in the book really is that there is a multiplicity of reasons for that, as there are potentially a plurality of implications to it. You put your finger on perhaps the most important one that I adduce or try to make a case for in the book, which is that forgetfulness of the past is perhaps a byproduct of modernity's persistent fascination with the future. That's to say, it's not so much a deliberate closing off of history, but it's rather, as it were, the collateral damage that he's done to our relationship with the past by this kind of multiple enthusiasm that the modern world has. You know, this is a book of big generalizations, of course. The modern world, the modern West, has for what's going to happen tomorrow.
Well, I think if I may interject, yeah, there are generalizations in your book. However, one of the strengths of the book is your ability to instantiate those generalizations into particular instances, meaning you talk about how this amnesia is working, for example, in a later chapter, which I'm glad it was later, in the academy itself, among supposedly the elitely educated and insightful group of scholars and academics and so forth. You talk about the UK, but the same is true, as you well know, in the United States. You talk about how it's instantiated in social media, in entertainment, in consumerism, in a way, in the very first principle of capitalism itself. You also talk about its roots in the impact of Christianity through St. Augustine on Western consciousness, although I think you're a little tough on him, but we'll talk about that later. But you do show all these connections, and you actually connect it to things like, you know, growing older, to how we view people who are older in our society versus how they were looked at earlier. You connect it to relationships, and you have fascinating comments about taking off from a comment that I think Tony Tanner said, that all novels are about adultery, to relationships themselves, to marriage. So you have a lot of very concrete connections that are very, very helpful way of understanding this big mess we're in right now.
Thank you. That is reassuring to know. Clearly, at one level, it does work with a very broad brush generality. And perhaps if I'm, you said we might come back to what I say about Augustine, but perhaps I might come back to that now.
Go right ahead,
if that's okay.
Yes.
I do feel, and I have had the opportunity to say this. I'm glad elsewhere. I do feel that what I say about Augustine and about Christianity at that particular moment is inadequate, and I've been perfectly properly picked up by readers for that. I hope at some stage, with if Bloomsbury are kind enough to allow me a paperback edition, that I might be able to come back and slightly redress.
Well, I think you redress it later in the book, actually, where you come back and you speak of certain communities of the Christian faith that still revere the past. But you have this notion of specific versions of the past, which I think Christianity obviously has its version of the past.
Yes, and I think what I probably should have done is to expand it a little bit more for readers on Christianity's deep attention to the past. I think what I was trying to do was answer the question, really quite a blunt question, which is, when did that sense from the ancient Mediterranean of looking backwards as the kind of primary source of identity and ethics, what were the major forces that changed that?
Yeah, because you begin with Mycenaean culture as representative of a culture whose meaning is rooted in its fidelity to tradition, to its past, to its own history.
Yes.
And then you use Augustine as a transition to the moment when we began, the West began to be forward-looking, as in towards heaven.
Yes, I think that's roughly right. I'm describing myself there. I think that was my first answer to this sort of 180-degree turn, as it were. You know, I mean, St. Augustine is interesting, isn't he? For many reasons, but not least for his sense that he wants to break from that ancient sense of, you know, where we got our identity from was the polis, the city, and within that city were a set of traditions, cultural practices, which to be sure excluded many people, but not everybody, and that, you know, for instance, the memory of ancestors and the maintenance of those traditions was what it was that gave the citizen, at any rate, a sense of who they were and where they belonged. So Augustine, you know, in the city of God, is answering that with the new Christian view that, you know, the polis, as it were, the city as identity, isn't a particular place. It is wherever you, the believer, are, because God is ubiquitous, not confined in some kind of polytheism to different locations. So, I mean, I was interested in Augustine because actually he was explicit in, as I read him at any rate, explicit in the break with that ancient way of thinking about human relationships with time and place.
I'm talking with Francis O'Gorman. We're talking about his book titled Forgetfulness, Making the Modern Culture of Amnesia from Bloomsbury. I think it's a very important book, and I really strongly recommend my readers pick this up. Whether you're from an academic background or not, it's very readable, it's very interesting, and it's written at the level of any serious interested reader could absorb easily. But Francis, I want to then move ahead from that moment, which is far less, I should say, amnesiac, if that's a word.
Yes.
To the post-Victorian world. I think, by the way, I think your way of interweaving your scholarly expertise in Victorian and Romantic literature with this whole story is just fascinating. And the way you treat George Eliot really opened up a way for me to look at Eliot that I had not seen. And by the way, I say to my listeners, anybody wondering what Middlemarch is about, just go read the two pages in this book about Middlemarch. But it becomes far worse, so to speak, than hankering after heavenly life when it moves toward actually defining your own meaning in terms of what lies ahead for you, or what will replace what is now with what will be. And that's a far worse, if I could use that word, far worse form of amnesia than what we saw in St. Augustine.
Yes. Yes, I think what's implicit in your comment is that amnesia isn't a terribly helpful term to think about St. Augustine, and I agree with that. I think that, I mean, the next kind of marking point in the book is the French Revolution.
Yes.
And it's rather more, you know, unquestionable effort to break from the past, albeit an effort that in a sense doesn't succeed, and, you know, France goes through this kind of backwards and forwards experience of returning to subversions of the ancien regime and then breaking from it again. But, you know, in principle, what the revolutionaries attempted to do was to demonstrate that ordinary people could change a culture's relationship with time, and that what they thought was a kind of permanent arrangement of government and social class and so forth could be overturned by their own dynamic intervention. And I think that that's as it works in the book, at any rate, is a key moment for particularly European as well as North American modernity. North America obviously having had its own earlier revolution, it's a key moment because it begins to power up the idea, it seems to me, that what is of particular value is what's going to happen next. That is to say that change, indeed revolution, becomes a kind of exciting or even necessary political idea to retain hold of. And so I make a kind of marker of that in the book, and then what I try to do is to narrate some of the other apparently unrelated features of the 19th and early 20th century, which seem to me to confirm in different ways that what is of value, what is of primary value, is what's to come. An obvious example of that would be the development, really, from the early 1840s of the communications technology, which provides us, really, essentially, with models with which we're still working.
If I could interrupt and just point out to our readers, you have this great section on technology, on Morse code, on the telegraph, on the steam engine, on the railroads. Then you, of course, you move into social media and so forth. And I can't think of any better metaphor, sadly, than what you're talking about is when you go out into the street, particularly a university town, and you see practically everyone walking around with their head bowed in front of a screen, waiting for what's going to come next.
Yes. It's a peculiar addiction, isn't it? I think. I mean, I understand that people studying our relationship with computers and tablets and smartphones are not shy of the word addiction. That one becomes, I think, for a number of reasons, particularly absorbed by the promise of the kind of intimacy, I suppose, that these things provide us with, even in the middle of a crowded street or, you know, on public transport or whatever it is. It is a sort of intimacy and a privacy.
Pacifier. I mean, it's a reminder to people that someone's thinking about them. Someone's intentionality is reaching out to them through a text, and that they're not really anonymous, even though they may feel anonymous and unimportant in a big crowd of people. Someone is thinking of them specifically at that moment in time.
Yes. It's a sort of. I think that's a very good way of putting it. Another book that I'm doing is about the cultural history of loneliness, and I think that that's an interesting way of thinking about our kind of intimate relationships with our smartphones and so forth, that it kind of sets up a network, as you say, of, you know, there is somebody out there thinking about me or communicating with me. But, I mean, your broader point about forgetfulness is also absolutely right, that, I mean, you know, they do involve variety of forms of forgetfulness, don't they? They involve us with forgetting the world immediately around us. I mean, sometimes
yes.
to our actual peril, you know.
Right.
Crossing the road.
Falling in holes and getting hit by a car.
Exactly. But also, they do reduce, it seems to me, they're one of the many contributors to that peculiarly contemporary sense that we are addicted to the future, sometimes the very short-term future. You know, we can see those little dots bumping up and down on the iPhone when somebody is messaging us. You know,
oh, that's perfect. Yes, exactly. And by the way, this isn't a detail in your book, but I found it really arresting because I connected with a book that had a big impact on me as a young man, Denis de Rougemont's Love in the Western World, where he talked about the essence of romantic love was that the beloved was not attainable. And, you know, Romeo and Juliet, Tristan and Isolde, and so forth. But you talk about the impact of this kind of, is futurism really isn't the right word? Let's just say this privileging of the next moment, the next day, the next year, and so forth. You write this about love. You say, the loved one in these terms is fungible, a supplement or an exchange with the past, and to that extent, falling in love expresses an ambition to arrive somewhere early in life to go backward. But falling in love, despite this pull of history and the chance to repair it, is still to occupy one's mind with an imagined future. And you add later on an imagined future which you can never reach.
Mm.
Which by definition you can never reach. So where does that leave romantic love, Dr. O'Gorman?
Yes, gosh, it's such a tricky one, isn't it? I think that what I was trying to probe there a little bit, and I hope to be able to do this a bit more elsewhere, but there I think I was trying to understand something from the psychoanalytical tradition about what desire really looks like. And I mean, one kind of commonplace of psychoanalytical theory would be that desire is that which is maintained until the object is
right.
Obtained. So that desire exists in a condition of absence or of not yet obtaining. I don't know what I think about that.
But by the way, you make the further point, which I think is even more important, that to have a family requires the very things that amnesia is denying. It requires stability for security. Mm. Our desire in a family is stability and security rather than the constant danger of that being overthrown or that being exchanged for something else.
Yes.
Now, you did not develop that to the extent I thought it deserved, frankly, because we're looking so many of the issues in our culture, including looking at iPhones all the time, has to do with young men and women who feel unattached, right?
Yes. I think that's absolutely right, and you're right that it is something of a throwaway comment in the book, which yes, I am trying to think about more. I think that it struck me recently, actually over Christmas, just how. As a reminder, just how important family rituals, whatever they are, whether it's to do with food or you know, going to church at this particular time or opening presents at this particular time, just how extremely important those are. Perhaps they're, for many people, they might be all that's left, in a sense, of, you know, the ancient Mediterranean's view that there were certain kind of rites and rituals that you needed to practice to stay together. So, you know, it's interesting to think about family groups that don't have any kind of, you know, what Yeats would call ceremonies. That's a grand term, but I'm talking about the humblest of things, really. And detaching oneself from those, having no kind of narrative in which one's own behaviour belongs, seems to me to be a very grave, kind of both moral and, as it were, psychic loss.
I think that's, I mean, that is be a great chapter for your next book on loneliness, if you're not already doing that. And we look forward to that. We're going to take a short break. I'm talking with Professor Francis O'Gorman from Edinburgh, where he is the Saintsbury Professor of English Literature. Is that how you pronounce it over there, Saintsbury?
Saintsbury, yes.
Okay, I got that right. So I hope I get more right when we come back from the short message.
On the next Cresta in the Afternoon.
Our topics during Cresta in the Afternoon toggle between church teaching and then using that teaching to shine a light on our world. We'll look at Christ and culture, church and world, religion and public life, from abortion to Zechariah and everything in between. Biblical criticism, Hollywood productions, academic debate, family and love, prayer and spirituality.
Cresta in the Afternoon from 4 to 6 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcha.
Sports, lessons, classes. Can you guess the best activity for kids to sign up for? It's family life. Extracurricular activities are nice, but not nearly as necessary as time with mom, dad, and siblings. Research shows that parents who prioritize regular time to work, play, talk, and pray together, emphasizing simple activities like family meals, family chores, a regular family prayer time, game nights, family days out, have happier, better behaved, more well-adjusted kids than parents who sacrifice daily family time to various activities. Don't let the village raise your kids. Step up and reclaim your family life. For tons of great ideas on family rituals, check out my book, Discovering God Together, The Catholic Guide to Raising Faithful Kids. I'm Dr. Greg Popcheck, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
If you've enjoyed Father John Ricardo's gift of teaching and preaching in the past, his new book, Heaven Starts Now, is the book for you. In his inspiring and incisive way, Father John addresses the obstacles we all face in becoming mature disciples. How do we learn to forgive? How do we combat fear and understand suffering? How do we worship the Lord, love others, and surrender our lives to God? How do we become saints day by day? Order online at AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab. That's AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab.
I am back with Dr. Francis O'Gorman. He is professor of English literature at the University of Edinburgh. He's talking to us from his home at Edinburgh. We're talking about a fabulous book of 2017, Forgetfulness, Making the Modern Culture of Amnesia. And, Francis, you know, I'm always, as a conservative, I'm always a little bit sensitive about critiques of capitalism and all that. But I think you make a very good point, and one which I take to heart, that with the impact of capitalism, and particularly of consumer-driven, market-driven capitalism, it is one of the most potent forces that does disconnect us from the past, because we're only as good as what we are able to purchase or to make our own. But then once we get it, of course, we have to go on to the next thing that's in fashion, or the next thing that will make us feel more real. I'm reminded of one of Walker Percy's great books, Lost in the Cosmos, where he talks about how can a woman with two closets full of clothes say she has nothing to wear? So talk to me a little more about your view of the capitalism issue, and is there an alternative, or is there a way of managing that, or is it just inevitable?
Yes, the first part of that question is much easier to answer than the second. The book is not an anti-capitalist book, but far from it. It is nonetheless, and in all kinds of ways, it seems to me the book is trying to, as it were, analyze unintended consequences, collateral damage, as it were, that might be produced by systems that are as good as we can get, derived by perfectly decent people. from that point of view, I suppose it's a slightly sort of negative book. One of the ways in which it is negative is to look at the unintended consequences of particularly of commodity capitalism and of advanced kind of stakeholder capitalism, which is one of the many, it seems to me, contributing forces to our collective kind of enthusiasm for what's going to happen next. Nobody wants their investments to produce, a line that's going downwards, of course.
Or even flat.
Exactly. That is simply a truth. But it is not even, at the same time, it's still something, isn't it, that gives us a peculiar kind of enticement to think about, indeed to worry about what's going to happen next.
Another way you make this point is to tie it with sort of the personal development move. Well, I'll call it a movement because I think it is. Self-help, the what's my plan to be a better person this year, to be thinner, to be stronger, to be smarter, to run faster, to have a lower handicap, to get elected the head of the country club or the garden club, or, this whole idea that you really get this time of the year that, what am I going to accomplish this year that's going to make me feel better about myself?
Yes. Yes, and I'm afraid on those kind of, as we say in the UK, personal development plans, I suppose the modern secular version, the kind of domesticated common or garden version, is the New Year's resolution. But, in professional terms, these forms that we are expected to fill out saying what it is that we're going to accomplish in the next, sometimes 5 years.
Well, you're working on 2 books that I know of. And by guys already got 23 books, doctor, heal thyself, kind of thing.
One of the things that interests me about this business is not only the way in which it encourages us really to forget the past and to say, what's really important is what I'm going to do next. The other thing that interests me about it is the way in which these documents and all their associated other documents kind of corral human lives into narratives. That's to say, they give us the illusion, it seems to me, that, the world works really by cause and effect, and that if I do this, that will happen. And somehow the future is manageable if I only make the right decisions. Now, sometimes, if we're lucky enough, we might be able to do that. That might indeed be true. But these documents don't, it seems to me, quite take into account the, and I hope I'm not speaking only for myself here, but the kind of fundamental disarray of what being alive actually feels.
Right. I think you make that point very well. How can we know what is waiting for us in the future? How do we dare think we can control it?
Yeah. And at the same time, also think that somehow there might be sort of punitive schemes, not least from our employers, if you know, if we don't manage to control it in the way that we said we would,
beware what you wish for or ask for?
Yes, or somehow that the sort of that very familiar, it seems to me at any rate, very familiar retreat of so many people away from actually what being a human being is like. Sorry, that sounds a very grand way of putting it, but I think that it's so easy to say we can manage what our futures will be. We can set down what our achievements should be and what we should be in the future measured against. It just seems to me that doesn't quite take into account the accidents and troubles and difficulties that most people, it seems to me, face on a day-to-day basis.
I agree with you completely. And by the way, as I read through your book, I kept thinking, this is why I'm not a sci-fi fan. I've never liked science fiction. And I get annoyed that so many films these days are of that genre. They're always like taking place in some future where the world looks like the inside of a beehive, and you know, 1956 Chevrolets are floating around somehow, nuclear powered in the grayness, so to speak. Are you a sci-fi fan, Francis?
It's very interesting that you should say that. I am not a sci-fi fan, and I think probably for the same reasons as you, I find it. I'm afraid to say to my friends who are sci-fi fans, it does nothing for me.
Exactly.
But a kind of corresponding thing would be that I am very interested in classic detective fiction.
Yes.
And I think that one of the reasons for that, actually, I mean, I don't want to over-intellectualize what's really just a kind of, late evening pleasure of reading another Sherlock Holmes story. But I do find that the world that, classic detective fiction gives us of cause and effect, however improbable it might be, is a kind of sort of reassuring counterpoint to the messiness of real lived life. It does give us a kind of illusion of narrative control and of things, as it were, being worked out.
Well, you make that point with the impact of technology on publishing, the way in which novels such as the Dickens novels were published, a month at a time, and that people got caught up in the what was to come about this story or this character. And I think isn't the detective story sort of the finely carved jewel of that kind of narrative?
Yes, I suppose that's right. It's a kind of sort of harmless and pleasurable version, isn't it, of modernity's biggest habit of thinking about what comes next. The narratives of detective fiction, or indeed, I suppose, in the 1860s of sensation fiction, Wilkie Collins' The Moonstone, for instance, do give us these kind of compensating narratives of, what's going to come next is at least in the end going to be a solution, a resolution. Things are going to come to a kind of climax of explanation. And so at one level, those kinds of texts partake of the modern enthusiasm for the next, but they also give us the reassurance of having got somewhere at the end of them. Something is known and explained.
So really, it's sort of this fine line between the fact that we have become future oriented in so many ways, but that not all of it is destructive to identity, self-identity, or human community or society. But yet we have come to the point where so much is harmful because it's become we have become addicted to a form of it which hurts our minds because it develops very short attention spans, that it isolates us from communities, from families, and that it sets up paradigms for relationships which are inherently fragile. And we could keep going. We could add to what I just said.
Yes, I think that's a very good summary. I mean, I didn't want it to be, as it were, a pious book in the sense that I didn't want to say all our thoughts about the future, as it were, are things that we shouldn't in some way or another be taking pleasure in. You know, I mean, wanting to own the, you know, the next, the fashionable pair of shoes or have the, I don't know, new recording of Tosca or whatever it is. You know,
I doubt it. The world is waiting for Tosca. You know, there's maybe a dozen of us in the world that are waiting for the next great performance of Tosca.
Well, I'm certainly one of them. These are things that keep us going, aren't they? You know, I mean, not having a future, let's put it the other way around, not having a future, not having, you know, I mean, Terry Eagleton makes a very important, I don't often agree with Terry Eagleton, but on this occasion I do, he makes a very important distinction between hope and optimism, and thinks, you know, living with hope is valuable, being merely optimistic is sometimes pernicious. So, yes, I mean, we do need to have a sort of sustaining creative relationship with the future. And, you know, nobody wants to get up in the morning and do exactly the same thing as they've been doing for, you know...
Except for autistic people. Which is very... Would you tell our listeners a little bit about how you situate them in this culture of amnesia?
Yes, this is a tricky one to try to explain, and I hope I got it right in the book.
I think so.
So my question was, in that chapter, do we have, are there any cultural signs that collectively, as it were, albeit obliquely, we register something of this anxiety about being... Do we register an anxiety about being detached from history? So I just looked at a few very prominent medical stroke cognitive narratives that circulate very, very visibly within our culture. Now, the first reason that they circulate so visibly is because they are very visible issues for people to deal with. I'm not obviously denying that. But I'm interested in why so many books, films, radio programs, and so on latch on to particular kinds of medico-cognitive narratives. I'm interested in that chapter in stroke recovery narratives, you know.
Yes.
One of my thoughts is, I wonder if in some way or another our interest in stroke recovery narratives sort of dimly, obliquely processes our general sense that we would like to, you know, kind of recover our memories.
I think you're right about that, Francis.
Thank you.
I do.
Thank you.
I think your points on autism are true as well. I myself quoted Oliver Sacks' book Awakenings in a book I wrote on happiness some years ago. I wrote a history of the idea of happiness because I thought it had a profound sense of, if you remember the comment where he gets a patient who's completely frozen still to move his arm when he throws a ball at him, and he describes it as taking the will of the ball. The patient took the will of the ball. And you make the same basic point when you talk about Oliver Sacks, in that there are ways of reconnecting not just patients but all of us with reality, with the past, with reality of the past, which can enliven us.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think that's very interesting that you've written about that too, and I should have known that. But I think that, one of the fascinations with awakenings is, it's an extraordinary story in its own right, but B, it seems to me to process a kind of cultural longing for getting our identities back again, remembering who we were. It's a kind of, part of its fascination is that, you can come back to being yourself.
Yes.
And I'm interested in that. And I think, just to return to your earlier point about autism, I think autism produces a great deal of narrative as well as kind of medical and psychological and psychiatric discussion at the moment, doesn't it? And
the need for repetition. The need for repetition.
Yes.
The need for not looking forward to change. The reason for for denying it.
I think that's exactly right. I was kind of interested in what sort of cultural work might be going on in the narratives of that condition.
Right.
That is to say that what you're looking at with a severely autistic person, as far as anybody knows, at any rate, is somebody that has only a kind of terrified relationship with the future, and that their security is in, as you say, in repetition and in not changing. So I'm kind of interested in that figure within modern narratives as a kind of extreme version of what modernity doesn't want, as it were. We don't want people who are terrified of the future. We want people to embrace the future. The figure of the autistic person, in a sense, emerges in narrative, it seems to me, as a sort of counter figure to modernity's preferred relationships with time.
I want to remind our listeners, I'm talking with Professor Francis O'Gorman from Edinburgh. We're talking about his book, Forgetfulness, Making the Modern Culture of Amnesia, from Bloomsbury last year. And I want to turn now to your comments about those of us who are growing older and to the attitudes of the culture toward those who are, I don't know how they define it anymore. I'm 68, but you're something like 17 years younger than I am, but you're probably feeling like you're part of the older now too.
Yes, that's correct.
And you make your point so eloquently that you have all of these institutions where they're clamoring for youthful leadership, but with that leadership, that you means a, means by definition a lack of experience, the kind of experience that only those of us with some years on us have. And don't these people that are clamoring for youth see the downside of what they want?
Yes, it's a worry, isn't it? That I'm particularly struck by the negative language that surrounds, usually without any evidential basis at all, that surrounds older people in a working environment. The kind of I don't know whether these are the same cliches in the US as they are in the UK, but there would be the old guard, people who are stuck in the past, stuck in the mud, resistant to change, and so forth. And it seems that so often these kind of terms are adduced as a rather unthinking relationship, to produce an unthinking relationship with people who have been, doing the job for a long time. And they are there's a kind of gateway to an often equally unthinking sense that fresh ideas produced by a lack of experience will be advantageous.
Right.
No, don't get me wrong. I'm not. I'm hugely welcome to fresh ideas and new people and youth. That's not my point. My point really is the ease with which the clichés are produced and opportunities are lost, I think. Opportunities for experience and thoughtfulness. It's often in my experience, the older generation with whom one is working is quite keen to change things, sometimes quite dramatically. So it's not a case that there's a kind of instinctive resistance to alteration.
And I would add that, in line with your comments about narrative depictions of stroke victims, of autistic kids, there's a lot of narratives out there about youth discovering the wisdom of age. This grubby, grumpy, grubby, balding guy in the corner actually is worth talking to.
Yeah, it's a distinctive feature, isn't it, of our particular culture? I think that. We're so ready to code older people in such negative terms. Nobody wants to be sentimental about this, and just because somebody has been doing the same job for such a long time doesn't necessarily mean they've got any better clue how to do it than somebody new coming in. But axiomatically, to dismiss them, I think, as resistant and old-fashioned and so forth, seems potentially to lose a huge kind of resource.
Yes, your book reminds me of so many different strands of stories of my own life and things that have impacted me and things I've read, people I've known, things I've loved, and so forth. But I remember many years ago in my first teaching job down in Atlanta, Georgia, an older professor saying to me how much better the world would be if there were more front porches. Which, again, is something I never forget, because it's front porch is the place where you rock and you smoke and you tell stories of the past and you don't worry about the clock, right? And you're either there in solitude or you're there with friends and family. It's a very anti-modern image.
Yes. That's a nice way of pushing it. But I think for me, what's really at the core of that book for me, I suppose, is the experience of teaching in universities for quite a long time now, and really finding that analytical and critical openness to the achievements, including but not exclusively the aesthetic achievements of the past, seems to become has become the preserve of a tiny number of people. So I set myself the question as to why we as a culture, kind of particularly educated culture, are losing what, for me, to put it this personally, has given me a lifetime's delight.
You and I are in total agreement on this, total agreement, as per our Tosca comment earlier. But we've run out of time, and I hope that sometime in the next few months you and I can get together again on the radio here on the show and take off a new conversation precisely from this point. You think you might be able to do that?
I should like that. Well, very much so.
Okay, well, I've been talking with Professor Francis O'Gorman from the University of Edinburgh. We've been talking about his latest book, Forgetfulness, Making the Modern Culture of Amnesia from Bloomsbury. I strongly recommend you get a copy and read. And once again, Francis, thanks very much for being a guest on Church and Culture today.
Great pleasure.
And after a short break, we'll be back with another wonderful guest.
From the Pews is celebrating 4 years on the air, and we have chosen to re-air some of the most powerful of the over 200 programs and personalities interviewed during those years, because they are just too good to be heard only once. Hi, this is Peggy Stanton. Please join me this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. The Michigan Winter Gathering of Catechetical Leaders will take place January 11th and 12th at the St. Francis Center in DeWitt. Come encounter Christ anew and learn how the Holy Spirit inspired the early church and is still working today. Reflections will be given by Father Paul Donnelly. To reserve your place, call 517-342-2440. That's 517-342-2440. If you'd like to publicize your upcoming event on the community calendar, you can enter it yourself at AveMariaRadio.net. Click on Community and then Community Calendar and fill out the fields for your event. Your event will appear on the internet calendar within a couple of days. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077. Catholic Radio, yours to keep and to grow.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Each week we go into the Ave Maria CD library. We pull on a talk or two to see what our Lord might have to say to us. Most of these talks are recorded at area gatherings and conferences. Most of the speakers are nationally known. The topics are varied, but they are all centered on the Lord, and they all are worth your listening time. You're back from Mass. It's not yet dinner time. Why not sit back and join us? Be fed on the Lord. Listen this and every Sunday afternoon at 3 for Putting On the Mind of Christ on 990 WDEL in the Metro Detroit area and 1440 WMAX in the Saginaw Valley. Putting On the Mind of Christ is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
This Sunday there's a classic passage on vocation. In the first reading, we hear the prophet Samuel telling of a forerunner, a precursor of the Lord Jesus. In the Gospel, John the Baptist points out the Christ, the long-awaited Messiah, the desire of the nations. And Andrew and his brother Peter follow him. Well, who am I, Samuel, John the Baptist, and Andrew? Who will bring me to Jesus, the source of all redemption? Now, there's a very helpful book called Return of the Prodigal by Henry Nouwen. He was a Dutch priest, a lecturer and famed spiritual writer who taught at Notre Dame, Yale, and Harvard, but threw it all away to look after the mentally handicapped at L'Arche. Return of the Prodigal is a commentary on the parable of the prodigal son. Soon it'll be the week of prayer for Christian unity. To think of other Christians returning prodigals is far too simplistic.